See, I had no idea what I was going to talk about. Is this thing working all right?
Yeah,
but better. We'll see how it goes. But at least I know how to work this, unlike some of my predecessors. So I was chatting a couple days ago with Alex Wright, and I said, you know, Mark wants me to talk about challenges in dark matter searches. What are the challenges? He said, well, we don't have any people, we don't have any money. We need new technologies. And he put this much less politely, the need guidance from theory part. He said, we haven't got a clue what we're doing. And so these were some of the challenges. So I think in looking at the agenda for this meeting, I think the getting guidance from theory part, I mean, this is really what we want to do in this meeting, is try and understand some of the new paradigms that we're doing research in. I'm going to talk a little bit about Spark, and yes, that's the way we pronounce this, Spark. It's supposed to be cute, but nobody likes it. But this is trying to solve the problem in Canada of too few people and not enough money, and also the integration of the community. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And then, well, because I'm the PI for Pico and we need new technologies, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Pico at the end and how it's trying to address some of these things. So, this is an out-of-date plot by now, but I like it just because when you look at, you know, the WIMP paradigm, where everybody has been focused for so long and trying to push all of these limits down, you see that we're running out of space, right? And people are really starting to think very much now, you know, okay, so maybe this WIMP miracle, where we expected the WIMPs to be sort of between the GEV and the TEV scale, where we will soon run out of ability to address that area, and it looks like nothing is coming up so far. And there's rather obviously this area down here, which is relatively unexplored, and relatively unexplored because it means going to lower WIMP masses and, of course, lower thresholds and so on. So I wanted to say a little bit about that. You know, if we have light dark matter, it's not your vanilla WIMP anymore. Very small cross-sections, so we would be overproducing dark matter. The universe would be overclosed, and we shouldn't have actually been able to attain our present age, right? We should have already undergone the big crunch, if it were. So this, which seems to be in contrast with observations, we're here. And there are various loopholes people have been trying to explore, that you could avoid this bound in some clever way, but it seems, looking at beta decays and so on, that lots of these loopholes are being ruled out. So we're kind of being forced, at least that's my view of things, but I want to learn a lot more about this at this meeting. But it seems like we're being forced to think about new interactions. And there's a half a dozen different portals that people are looking at, different ideas. And you know, which one of them are sensible, I don't know. Which ones can we explore experimentally? We have to look at very carefully. And because of that, there's been all kinds of new experiments being promoted, looking at beam dump experiments, looking at targets where you have this invisible decay, and then you try and match the vertex and try and look for invisible particles and so on. But I still think there's a little bit of room for direct detection. Not a lot, because we're pushing down in thresholds, but I want to say a little bit more about some room there. And this is the challenge. So if you take your favorite nucleus, whether it's fluorine or argon or germanium or xenon, and you look at the, as a function of WIMP mass, what the recoil energies are, you see that when you get down here, everything is getting rather small, so I had to blow that up, and you see that you get a few KeV of recoil energy at these very low WIMP masses. So that's the thing, is can you get down to thresholds that are sub KeV? And we heard this morning from CREST that they're doing a phenomenal job using the ionization signal, which is great. I think that's going to be a real plus for the field. There's one other thing I wanted to point out, because I'm not sure people pay much attention to this, but when you look at the rate, of course, the plot that I had on the previous page was just for one fixed velocity of 220 kilometers per second. But of course, you have a broad range of velocities. And when you do the calculations properly and calculate the rate and you put in the motion of the Earth as well as the escape velocity, this escape velocity actually gives you this turnover, the sharp cutoff. And so you're fighting against that as well. And so because of that escape velocity, your rate is plummeting as you get close to that velocity, that energy. And so it means all of the interesting physics is down here at the lowest possible recoil energies. Okay, so this is all pretty obvious. And I say low thresholds are hard to achieve, and I'm gonna work through just one example, but obviously the signal is weak. Electronic noise becomes a problem, the radioactive backgrounds become more plentiful, everything is working against you, and yet your detectors are getting much larger, so you need to have this full coverage, which means more channels, more electronic noise possibility, and so on. So I just thought, because I was thinking actually there would be a lot of theorists here who maybe don't think this all through, but just imagine a conventional 50-ton scintillator-based detector. And so in that case, well, I took rho to be 1 just to estimate the volume, but signals are typically about tens of thousands of gammas per MeV. That's fairly typical for a scintillator. So at a 2 kilovolt threshold, it implies 20 gammas only. That's the best you can do. So the PMTs, if that's what your technology was, you'd have a single photoelectron in each one of those. Typically, quantum efficiencies for your PMTs are 25%. You're down to 5 photons. And for 50% photocathode coverage, which is pretty good, you need thousands of standard sort of 8-inch PMTs, just to give a feeling. And the only reason I put that in there is then I started worrying about the dark current. You're often digitizing these signals, for example, for argon to get the signals out. So if your dark current is 1,000 hertz and you measure for a millisecond, then you start upending with problems of pileup. So we have a problem that we need better technology that will have lower noise, lower dark current, lower cost, because you're going to have thousands of channels. We have to improve if you want to still use scintillation. And so my argument is there's still some room in the scintillation sector that you can improve things by, because you can improve the quantum efficiency up to a factor of 4, and you can improve on the dark noise and so on. So you might have several factors of 2 and 4 in here that you might get an order of magnitude better sensitivity overall. Backgrounds are also a problem, so just again to give you a concrete example, so I just picked deep argon, where the problem with argon for the backgrounds, one of the major problems is the argon-39. So argon-39 though, normally you'd say, oh, I don't care about argon-39, look, it's parts in 10 to the 16, right? Grams per gram compared to normal argon. It's produces this electron, which is a problem, it has a long half-life. But if you actually put in the numbers, 10 to the minus 16 grams per gram sounds absolutely tiny. But when you calculate the rate, it's 1 becquerel per kilogram. So for an experiment the size of deep, you end up with 3,600 becquerels decays per second. And you just multiply that out. It's 10 to the 11 decays per year. And so to avoid that, this tiny little thing, to avoid the signal that you're worried about, you need discrimination at better than 10 to the 10. So that's the challenge. How do you know that of all of those electrons, you didn't get the answer wrong once in 10 billion attempts, right? And so, well, the solution for our future argon detectors will be to get rid of the argon-39 by going and sourcing argon from deep underground. And so far, I'm not sure exactly what the numbers are. I seem to remember it's about a factor of 200 now is roughly where they are in terms of the amount of depletion of argon-39 that's possible. So this is all lead up to what I want to discuss. But for background mitigation, basically you need exquisite particle identification, discrimination against your backgrounds compared to your signal. We need to develop that ability. We need better counting techniques because all of our materials have to be so clean. It's very hard to measure something at this level, 10 to the minus 16. So we need better counting techniques to screen the materials that are going into the detectors. Often the final detector that can actually measure it will be the detector you're trying to make the measurement with. And we have to be able to build detectors with cleaner production, which means working largely underground to build our detectors. So I'm pretty obvious example is copper, which is built underground and so on. So I wanted to talk about a little bit how we're addressing that in Canada. We need new ideas, we need money, and we need people. And so what we have recently been awarded, CIFREF funding for something we call SPARC. SPARC is this Canadian Particle Astrophysics Research Center. We got an award of $64 million. It's hosted at Queen's University, but the idea is to support the Canadian community in terms of personnel and resources, but also make this something that's a boon to the entire community. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit about SPARC in a couple of slides. I won't go into a lot of detail, but the main goals are, one is to expand on the scientific culture. And what I mean by that is not just Snow Lab experimentalists working together, but to bring, as to the degree we can, the entire community together, where we have the experimental program, we have theory in both astroparticle and astrophysics, we have our colleagues involved who are the observational astronomers who are telling us about the dark matter and what they interpret their cosmology, but then also people who are working on the detector development and low background techniques. So that was one of the main focuses of the program. What we want to do is build this team with the critical mass and skills that we would like to be position ourselves that Snow Lab, as a wonderful facility, is available, and the community will start to coalesce around some major new experiments, which are the next generation experiments, which will have to be truly at the global scale, right? But the next size, you know, once you start doing things like Darwin or the large argon experiments, it's going to require the coalescence of groups around those projects, I think. And so we would like to create an environment where people see Snow Lab as a place that is receptive, and that we have the wherewithal within Canada through SPARC and the existing community to help deliver that science. We want to, of course, make sure our current program is successful, because without that, it will be difficult to position ourselves to move on. So part of the job is to finish up the current suite of experiments while we're designing and getting ready for the next suite. There are other things I won't talk about, but there's, as usual, there's connections to industry. There are an education component and a large outreach component. And the outreach component, we're actually really excited about, and we want to work very closely with people here at Perimeter and Triumph and Snow Lab who have already established outreach. But the main focus is going to be on the science. So that's what SPARC is doing. We have focused, I mean, the goal is to follow our noses a little bit. We started out by saying that the technologies we want to pursue at the moment are this photosensor R&D, because that seems a real weakness in the field. That in general, photomultipliers are not an adequate solution anymore. We know that we have to do a lot better on the low backgrounds, and SPARC is meant to be this catalyzing entity that works with the universities on the R&D, works with students, and works with engaging the industrial partners. So that's what SPARC is. Queen's is hosting it, but we have 7 other universities and 5 other institutions in Canada that are all partners. And I won't say much more than just this, but to give you a feeling of the scale of things, we have 7 new faculty members at Queen's University, including, in fact, there's only one really that's what we would call a true Snow Lab experimentalist, but we're trying to build a bit of a theory group. We have people that are on the border between particle physics and theory, particle physics and astrophysics. But we also want to build up our capability in terms of, you know, It's kind of embarrassing, but we don't like to admit it, but there's many times we have a whole bunch of physicists sitting in one room and we say, gee, wouldn't it be nice if we had a chemist here? We don't say it out loud, of course, but you know, the low background stuff especially. And so we have tried to build capacity at Queen's that we have quite a bit of interdisciplinary expertise. And then we have seven other faculty members across Canada and an equivalent to faculty position at Triumph. So that's 15 faculty positions across Canada altogether that we're filling. And then we have research scientists, project managers, about 20 technical positions, and then postdoctoral fellows and students and so on. So altogether, we're supporting over 100 positions, new positions in Canada through this initiative. So I think it's a healthy injection into the field. And we have some administrative people, of course, and so on. But I won't go into it a lot, but this is in terms of the education part, I'll be looking out to the community because we really want to embed not just undergraduates, but graduate students at all stages of their career, and we would like them to go and work at Grand Sasso or go and work at Fermilab and get, you know, have some student exchanges and so on. So to have some cross-fertilization in the field a bit. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about Spark, but I did want this community to know about it because I think it will help with building relationships between the experimentalists and the theorists, which is part of the goal for this. I did want to talk a little bit about a novel detector technology. So this is a recycled idea because it's bubble chambers, but this is PICO. And I just, because this is also something new that's happening in Canada, I wanted to mention this. It does have reasonably low threshold sensitivity, very good particle discrimination. That's its real benefit. And I'm not allowed to say, but the funding for this, we're all very happy. It's all the results are embargoed, but it looks like that the next generation of PICO is going to go ahead. And through Spark, we have actually ended up with a number of faculty who are interested in working on the PICO bubble chamber, so our manpower is not being so much of an issue. So it's a bubble chamber, which means it uses a superheated fluid. And just to remind you how that works, if you look at the saturation curve, when you're sitting on the saturation of curve, of course, you're in equilibrium between the gas and the liquid, the same pressure, same temperature, same chemical potential. It turns out, if you look at the potential, it actually has this double hump structure, and it tends to be either all liquid or all vapor. But if you start here, if you start up here with your detector in the liquid phase, so that you have positioned yourself in this hump, and then you drop the pressure, so now you should be in the gas phase, what actually happens as you do that is you're distorting this potential. And so you end up, if you started in the liquid phase, as you drop the pressure down to here, you should be in the gas phase, but you end up as a superheated liquid. And of course, it wants to be a vapor, but it's in this metastable state. And what it requires, pardon me, is a little bit of energy to get you over this hump. And that you can tune your detector by lowering the pressure. And as you lower the pressure more and more, this hump starts to disappear, and you require a tiny amount of energy to take yourself from the superheated state into the vapor state. So that's the goal, and you can, of course, control the pressure and temperature and control your degree of superheat, and you can lower your threshold down to the point that as low as you can get before you start getting spontaneous nucleation of bubbles over this hump. So the way the detector works is this is an old picture. We've changed the design a little bit, but you have a superheated fluid here. You keep it as a liquid initially. At high pressure, it's a liquid. Then you drop the pressure down here, and now it's superheated. And now you wait for something to trigger a phase transition. And you can wait, and we can wait thousands of seconds. The detector is so stable underground that nothing will happen for thousands of seconds. But if some source of energy comes in that triggers this expansion, then suddenly the pressure goes shooting up because all the liquid starts to boil. you can see the bubble. So we look at these visually with high-speed cameras. It's actually our trigger, and I'll show you some pictures in a moment. So you know exactly where the event occurred because you see it as clear as day. You can see the multiplicity, how many bubbles were produced. It turns out that when the bubble is formed, it makes quite a big pop, and so you hear it acoustically, so you get a loud microphone. So here, I'll show you on the next picture, on the next slide of pictures. And then the pressure also gives you an indication that something's happening, because the pressure rise goes up. And after we have taken pictures of the thing for a few hundred milliseconds or so, or less, then we raise the pressure to put it back in this stable state, and then very gingerly drop the pressure again, and we're ready to go again. And we can run, as I said, for hours if we need to without a single event. So it's not firing off at a high rate. So this is just for a screenshot. This was an event where there are two bubbles. There are two pictures here just because we have two cameras that allows us to find the position through the stereo angle. And you see that at the time the bubbles appeared, there was on our microphone, suddenly bang, there's an appearance of a signal. We had three microphones on this particular detector. And then after a while, we say we've taken pictures for long enough. We'll now apply the pressure to put it back in the stable state. And then, of course, the microphones go nuts at that point. So that's what it looks like. So I said it has exquisite background or background rejection capability. So it turns out that gammas and betas interacting in the detector deposit their energy along quite a long track. And for this detector to work, what you need is you put all of your heat has to be very localized to cause this phase transition. So we are naturally quite immune to this electron gamma signal because, well, because they deposit along the track a little bit of energy here, here, and here. None of those individually are able to cause a phase transition. We've been playing around with different fluids, so CF3I, which gives us a spin independent, and the spin and fluorine, which gives us a spin dependent sensitivity. But you can see if we drop the threshold down to, say, about 3 keV, then we have about 10 to the 10 rejection factor against gammas and betas, which is extremely good. And so what we're exploring now is, you know, how far can we push this? What do we actually need in terms of gamma rejection, and how low can we get? And we've gone down well below 2 keV now. One of the big problems we thought was going to be alphas, because alphas behave very much like nuclear recoils, but turns out they're sufficiently different. We always think of alphas as traveling no distance, but in fact their track is 40 micrometers on average in our fluid compared to some tens of nanometers for the recoiling nucleus that goes the other way. And it turns out that makes a difference. The sound that is produced turns out to be proportional to the volume acceleration rate. And you can imagine that if these all start to produce a protobubble and then that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and then eventually they all coalesce, you're starting with something that's a bit cigar-shaped compared to something that's purely spherical. And it turns out, therefore, the volume expansion rate, acceleration rate is different. And we can hear the difference. And so this is a parameter which measures the intensity of the sound. But when we are running just normally, we're dominated by alphas. And so those are this parameter that measures this amplitude, if you like, of the sound for alphas. And when we bring a neutron source close by, then the amplitude is down here. And so we can clearly hear the difference between an alpha and a recoiling nucleus, which gives us another discrimination factor.
Are alphas coming from the walls?
Or alphas largely from the walls, but there is a contamination in the liquid itself, which is just from the uranium and thorium. And then finally, for neutrons, if you have a single interaction and you produce one bubble, we would never know whether it's in the neutron or a recoiling nucleus. But even on our small chambers, we had about three to one in terms of the number of times you have multiple scattering compared to single scattering. So a large fraction of the time when a neutron comes in, it will actually, this is one of our record ones, but it will start to bounce around and you'll get all of these bubbles produced simultaneously. and it's a pretty clear signal. And so, as I said, on a one-on-one, you don't know if you only see one bubble, but if you end up with a, quote, claim for dark matter, a collection of events, and you're wondering if it's neutrons, well, 60 or 70% of the time there should be multiples, so you have to see that signal as well if it's neutrons. So just to, I don't know if this will work, but just to give you a visualization, this is an example where you have a single bubble. This is where you're trying to see the event, and you see the bubble is there. We take pictures for it a while. Now we're applying the pressure, and it collapses again, right? So that's the signal, and it's unmistakable, right? I should badly place mouse, but it just appears. The camera triggers on that easily. You can measure the XYZ position because there are two cameras. This is an example of when we bring a neutron source by, what you get, and you see, boom, it's visually very different, and it's there's no mistaking multiples. You know, there are always, of course, at the edges. You know, we're working on improving the optics around the edges to get all the pictures a little better, but it works rather well. So I wanted to tell you just so PICO 60 recently published a new result, and we did it as a blind analysis. The way we made it blind, we actually call it deaf, not blind, because in our case it's an acoustic signal, but we were deaf. So we didn't allow ourselves to look at the acoustic signal, which meant we can't tell the difference between if an event was produced by an alpha or a recoiling nucleus. And when we, at the end of our run, we had 106 events. We know, as you pointed out, that a lot of the radioactivity is right on the edge, on the glass walls. So this is an unfolding. This is R in this direction, and this is the Z. So if you unwrapped that, you have a picture of our cylindrical detector. And so we defined a fiducial volume before we started that said we're going to avoid the walls, and we're going to avoid the collar, the interface at the top, and just look at the bulk fluid. And it's a pretty big fiducial volume. We didn't cut out very much. and we ended up with 106 events, of which, as I said, we had no idea whether they are alphas or whether they could be nuclear recoils. If they were all nuclear recoils, it'd be interesting as a dark matter signal. What we had calculated in advance was that we expected about 0 to 3 bulk singles would be consistent with neutrons, because we know roughly what our neutron background is, given our shielding underground at SNOLAB. So that was where we stood, and then we unblinded ourselves so that we could tell how many of these were recoils and how many were alphas. And when we did that, this is our window where we're looking for things. This is a calibration for neutrons. What we were looking for is a number of events here, and we had 0 events. So we didn't see any events. They were all consistent with alphas. I might point out, it's kind of cute. The alphas actually, because they're different parts of the chain, they have different energies, and you can do alpha spectroscopy. You can measure the energy of the alpha particles as they go through your detector. But we ended up with 0 singles, even though we might have anticipated a couple from neutrons. And it was consistent with our nuclear recoil hypothesis. But what was really nice about this was that we saw 0 background events, right? And so the detector was proven to be able to be run in a back-free mode, background-free mode, at least at this scale of 60 kilograms. And we did that through a blind analysis. And that allowed us to set, this is spin-dependent sector, but you see that we have made a substantial improvement in pushing the limit down for PICO 60. And by roughly a factor of 17 over what we had before, by basically by making the backgrounds free detector. So this gave us enthusiasm to continue this technology. And where we're headed now is two things. One, we are currently setting up a similar size detector. We realized that all this time we've been running the detector upside down. So now we're going to turn it what we call the right side up. I won't go into a lot of detail on that, but it's so we wanted to run a short test just to make sure we're right that we've been running it upside down. The reason is that in the original version, we had the fluid here and we had a buffer fluid on top. Why was the buffer fluid there? Well, we had all this mechanics up above, which was potential source of background. So we wanted this part to be inert. And so we filled it with water or some other fluid that was inert, and then our superheated part was down here, and that's what we look at with the cameras. But it turns out we had a problem with very tiny particulates, nanometer scale particulates, probably coming off the bellows up here in the flange and stuff. And of course, they rain down on your detector, worst possible thing. We also had a problem at the interface between the buffer fluid and the active fluid. And you get away, you can remove all those problems by turning the detector upside down. Now you can't have a buffer fluid, but it's all an active fluid. If you do create any particulates, they're produced down here, and they fall down, and they never get into your active area. And the way we do it now, instead of having a buffer fluid, is we make this relatively warm, so it's active, and we keep this side cold, so it's inactive. So any particulates or noise created from all of the mechanics down here never gets up into your active area. And we don't have an interface anymore. The buffer fluid is gone. So that's the idea. So we want to test that, and we're constructing that underground. It will give us a little bit of increased physics reach because we will operate it for longer. But really, it's the technology for the future that we want to test for this larger scale, order of magnitude larger detector, which we are now designing and building. So so this is just to say that the CFI decision for funding, I'm not allowed to tell you how that went, but we're all happy. And the engineering work is ongoing. So we have to finalize the design of this by early 2018 and work with CFI to get the money all defined properly. But by early 2018, we imagine sometime in that first quarter, actually starting to build components. There's some long lead components. The silica quartz vessels are very difficult to machine, they actually still blow them, believe it or not. But that's a long lead item, so we'll start procuring some of those things rather early. But we hope to be up and running by late 2018.
Tony, of that building that you showed there, does anything exist already? The water tank or something?
Well, yes, that's a bit of a sore point. We always use this drawing just to demonstrate the scale. This is the deep tank already in existence. This is the mini clean tank already in existence. And it's just very convenient that our detector would happen to fit inside the mini clean tank if the mini clean disappeared. And the program for mini clean is coming to an end on roughly the same time scale as what we're looking at. So we envision moving into this tank sometime in 2018. Of course, we will work very closely with Snow Lab to make sure that we don't inconvenience mini clean and pull them out any earlier than necessary. But that's the plan. But there is a bit of technical work to make the tank work for us compared to mini clean. But yes, that exists. Okay. And if you look at where we're going, so here we are. This is, again, just the spin-dependent sector. We do have a bit of spin-independent sensitivity, especially at the low mass side. But with Pico 500, we aim to get down here. And so that will be very competitive with it. So we're on protons with fluorine. LZ, of course, is sensitive to spin dependent on the neutrons, and will be in the same sort of vicinity as LZ. One thing to point out, although I don't know how to make use of it yet, because I don't want to build another order of magnitude bigger detector, but as was pointed out this morning, the neutrino floors are very different compared to what your material is, and for C3F8, we still have three orders of magnitude to go before we reach the neutrino floor. I can't imagine how I would build a three order of magnitude larger bubble chamber, though. So, I think that's all I wanted to say. I think we've demonstrated that the technology is working. It's a nice one for exploring the low mass, where low mass still is at the GeV scale, where it's difficult to get much below a GeV. But I think it's an interesting technology with low background demonstration. And as I say, we want to push that down another couple orders of magnitude before we wrap this program up. So I think that's all I wanted to say.
Questions?
covered this and I missed it, but why are the Super K and Ice Cube lines dashed?
I have no idea why they're dashed. Maybe because they depend on the particular model that you've selected.
Yeah, no, I'm just wondering.
I mean, there are real limits. They're not projections, which is, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One is on the possible future. So, I mean, one of the great advantages of this technique is the automatic reduction of the gamma.
Right.
So, but is there any thought of actually, you know, going for the dark matter electron scattering with this technique?
We're certainly exploring it, and I would say it's too early to say very much. There is a half of the collaboration which is quite optimistic that you can pull something out, and there's half that don't believe the other half. That's kind of where we are.
And then I have another question on the C part.
Right.
So, I mean, this is fantastic, obviously, for the Canadian community. I was wondering if you have foreseen something for the outside community.
Well, it's very much about trying to facilitate more international collaboration. In terms of putting money, in terms of people and resources, that's not going to happen. But it's meant to facilitate collaboration. So there's a lot of money that's put in there for travel, for building collaboration purposes, for workshops, all that sort of stuff. And so, for example, there's a movement within Canada to push, well, the Canadian Argon community are getting into dark side with an idea that maybe a future dark side would come back to Snow Lab, and so it's a technology, and we will support all of that to the degree we can. So yes, it's meant to be very international in scope by pushed through resources in Canada.
Maybe you can show the figure where you go further. Yeah, that one. Okay. So, you know, with Pico 500, depending on the channel, you're getting to the point that the Super K, Ice Cube, et cetera, can never improve beyond that point. So they have their own, a different neutrino flow, not this neutrino flow.
That's right.
It's a high energy neutrino flow. And you know they can never get beyond minus 41 or minus 42, depending on the channel. So it really is going to depend upon experiments like this.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Let's thank Dr.